Battery's a little low. I hope it lasts. If not, I've got a spare battery I can put in if I know to stop. So I can see it. All right. So let me start by saying a little bit about why the chapter is where it is in the course. Because England, we've been looking at a couple of feud systems, at Iceland and Somalia, or Somali systems, which are basically feud systems. England in the 18th century is not a feud system, but it is a privately prosecuted system, so it's sort of partway there. And we will shortly be looking at classical Athens, which again is not a feud system, but is a privately prosecuted system. And it seemed to me interesting. And of course, our court system is a privately prosecuted system. In that sense, all of these, in a way, are other societies with elements of tort. And it's interesting to see where does it differ, how does it work, and so forth. We'll be looking at the Irish system also, and it's a little unclear whether that's really a feud system or not. Possibly not. But in all of these cases, I think, part of the incentive for prosecution is what I think of as private deterrence. That is, if you think about a feud system, after you've injured me, why do I, am I willing to go to a lot of trouble and risk in order to make sure you pay me wehrgeld or you get killed or something? Because if I don't act that way, people will know I'm a pushover, and since there isn't a formal legal system to protect me, I'll be in serious trouble. And one of the things that I remember occurring to me a long time ago is that people, in explaining things like why somebody prosecutes in 18th century England or even in the Icelandic case, sometimes put it in terms of vengeance. People feel vengeful and they want to punish the person who's hurt them. And from my standpoint, vengefulness is not a fact of nature given from on high. It is rather one of the tactics that we use in order to solve certain problems. That vengefulness, I think of as a commitment strategy. You sort of train yourself to be the sort of person who will feel badly if he is wronged and the person who wronged him doesn't get punished. And other people observe you're that kind of person, and therefore they don't wrong you because they know it's dangerous. So I find it useful to think of various things that are usually thought of as sort of psychological givens as something more like chosen commitment strategies, which maybe you consciously chose and trained into yourself. Maybe your parents brought you up that way because they knew it was better to be that kind of person. Maybe even Darwinian evolution, you know, hardwired those characteristics into your genes. It doesn't matter very much from my standpoint. The interesting point is that being vengeful in certain environments is actually an asset, being recognizably vengeful. This is a related number of different ideas, but which all are connected with the fact that human beings are not very good liars. That, in a sense, the ideal strategy would be to have everybody believe you will avenge wrongs against you, and then if you're in a situation where avenging a wrong against you is likely to get you killed, you don't do it. And I think a lot of this started out with the puzzle of why there are people who won't steal even if nobody's watching. Why are people virtuous? And part of my answer is, if your utility function was written on your forehead, people could tell whether you were that kind of person. In all voluntary interactions, it is in your selfish interest to be somebody who won't steal if nobody is watching. Because if people know you are, that makes you more attractive as a trading partner, more attractive as an employee, employer, spouse, and so forth. And if you work through the sort of the economics of it, the cost to me of having an employee who steals from me is greater than the benefit to him. Because he gets and I lose whatever he steals, but I also spend time and effort trying to keep him from stealing, and he spends time and effort trying to steal, looking for opportunities. Both of those are deadweight costs. They're net losses. So therefore, in a sense, I would be better off if I could somehow make a binding contract with him not to steal from me. And so would he be. I'd be willing to pay a price higher than the cost to him of being so restrained. If you think of being a virtuous person as observable, that's like that, and therefore it's in your selfish interest to be a virtuous person. As far as voluntary interactions are concerned, it's not clear that it's true for involuntary interactions. And then my claim is your utility function is written on your forehead, although it's a little bit blurry, in the sense that human beings are continually giving a sort of a monologue about the inside of their head in face expressions, in voice tones, in gestures, and a bunch of other stuff. And it's not impossible to lie about it, but it's hard. That, you know, the people who are really talented at pretending to be personality X when they're really Y are called con men. And, you know, some people can do that. They're scarce. And part of the reason is that to do that, you've got to simultaneously be running two mental processes. You've got to be simultaneously saying, if I were the person I'm pretending to be, what would I be thinking so that I could act and so forth like that person? But by the way, do I have a good opportunity to swindle somebody at the moment that is thinking of the person I really am? That's hard to do. So I think you can make some sense out of a number of patterns of behavior that we sort of think of as just irrational or given to us somehow as being sensible commitments rather than sort of, and vengefulness is one of them, which is where this digression comes back to home. All right, so those were sort of the initial comments I wanted to make about why I'm covering this here, that I have a whole chapter in my law and econ book on why we have both criminal law and tort law. And I think it's sort of an intriguing question that most law students and law professors don't think about, that there are two different ways of doing about the same work. And one of the things I found fun about looking at all these legal systems is seeing the different ways in which that set of issues gets. Now, you said you had things you didn't understand. Do you want to start now or somebody else?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I was wondering about the cost of the crime.
Yes.
So, one of your efficiency arguments dealt with how a tort-like system could be more efficient because it cuts down on like overhead costs, essentially, for operating costs of the system. Because if the prosecutor can settle the matter outside of court, that's much more efficient.
That saves the punishment cost of the argument there.
Right. But my issue with that is then the prosecutor is setting the cost of the crime, whereas in our system, it's like the organizer that sets the cost of the crime. And
yes.
So in these two different systems, we have two different, like the same crime will give you two different costs.
Yes.
And in our system, particularly, it's the, I would say that it's the victim who mostly said, like, it's the cost of the victim that impacts.
You're talking about tort law now, not criminal law.
Actually, we just dropped that whole bit.
Right.
But, like, my main point is that it doesn't make a lot of sense to allow the prosecutor to set the cost of the crime.
The private prosecutor,
right?
Because who is the victim?
Right, because if he's rich, the crime will be very costly. But if he's poor, the criminal can get out for much less.
I'm not sure I see that. It would seem to me that the question is more nearly how rich the criminal is.
Okay, and that would be another factor.
Right, if the criminal has lots of resources, and I say, look, there's a fair chance I can get you hanged, he may be willing to pay me off with quite a lot of money. And I do discuss that in the chapter and suggest that feature of it is biased against rich people.
But if the prosecutor is very rich, he won't accept anything but a lot of money.
Why? Poor people like money, too. If the prosecutor is poor, it seems to me he will also be happy if he can get the criminal to pay him a lot of money.
If the poor prosecutor is offered a certain number of dollars, he might be more tempted to accept that amount.
Isn't that going to depend on how much he thinks he can get?
No, because his situation will cause him to judge the criminal's position differently.
If he knows the criminal's got money, it seems to me he's going to have a natural inclination to try to get as much of it as he can, though.
Right, but he might be less, how do you say, risk averse. Like he wants to settle more than a very affluent prosecutor.
That could be. You could certainly imagine somebody who says, 100 pounds for sure is better than 200 pounds with a 50% chance or something. I guess that's possible. The question of really fully fit, I think the point that I was making there was one dimension of efficiency, namely the punishment costs. That more generally, if you assume that the state is wise and benevolent, then it can set the optimal, not only the optimal punishment, but the optimal probability of catching criminals, because you've got to spend resources catching and convicting criminals. And it then becomes a more complicated question to ask whether you can have private institutions that do the same thing. But they wouldn't be these private institutions, because these are private institutions where the state is already setting the punishment, namely hanging in the English case. But if you're interested, I do have a discussion in a fully private system. Some of it is in my book, Machinery of Freedom, which is on a PDF, which is on my webpage, and some of it is in a chapter on economics. Yes. I can't remember the title of it, but there's a chapter I can find you the link if you want. It's also on my webpage, a chapter I contributed to someone else's book, where I'm trying to work out the logic of in what sense a fully private system will generate the optimal level of punishment. I'm imagining there a system where individuals or customers or private firms, the private firms bargain between each other to agree on courts, and then the question is, I, as a customer, want the optimal combination, as it were. How closely does that fit sort of social optimum in the normal sense?
Is the customer the criminal?
No, the customer is the potential victim. Well, both really, because what's really happening in that system, which is much more private than what I'm discussing here, even more private than the Icelandic system, is everybody is a customer of some firm that protects his rights. The firms bargain with each other on courts. So that means that both the customer and the criminal both the victim and the criminal are customers. And of course, when you become a customer, you don't know which you're going to be, because criminal in this case really means defendant, means somebody who's charged with an offense. And therefore, you are in effect buying into a set of legal rules in that system. So if you're curious, I can point you where, because I do actually discuss the efficiency issue at some length there. But really, I think in this chapter, I'm not really thinking about what the optimal level of punishment is, because I don't think this system would generate it. I'm rather saying that an efficiency advantage of the out-of-court settlement is that a fine is a more efficient punishment than execution and imprisonment is. And I think that's a fairly straightforward argument. Now, I should say I have another article which I don't think was written long after this one, and I don't think I've added it to the footnotes, but I probably ought to, which is on the inefficiency of efficient punishments. And the argument I'm making there is that the problem with a really efficient punishment is that you have an incentive to impose it whether or not the other person is guilty, because a really efficient punishment is one where what the criminal loses, someone else gets. And that then you have to worry about the incentives of the prosecutor and of the legal system as well as the incentives of the criminal. I explore there this. I basically propose ways in which you could make our legal system more efficient in terms of punishment. And the question is, why don't we? Yeah?
For the clergyable offenses, are they, in a sense, analogous to affirmative defenses in criminal cases? In that, essentially, you're just getting off by having committed a crime that's heinous, but maybe on the grounds of
I don't think so. As far as I can tell, and I'm not certainly an expert in the relevant history, they were really more nearly a result of inertia. That is, that what's happening is that in the early period, say early Norman England, the church is running its own system of courts. And the church really sees itself and is seen as sort of an independent sovereign. It's not as though the church belongs to the king, as it were. The church belongs to the pope. He's a long way away.
How is it extended to everyone?
Because the historical sequence, as I understand it, it sort of seems a little bit weird, is the original rule was that a clergyman who would charge with certain offenses in the royal court could plead benefit of clergy, and it was more like changing jurisdiction. It was more like saying, I'm under the jurisdiction of the church courts because I'm their citizen rather than your citizen. That's the closest analogy I can come to. And he would then be tried by the church procedure, given a punishment that, if he was convicted, that the church set, and so forth. And then the problem was, how do we define a clergyman? And this is a society where much of the population is illiterate, where you don't have the kind of bureaucracy and so forth and so on. It's not like you can look up, you know, the list of employees of the church somewhere. However, the clergy at the time are the main literate class. And so the rule develops that if you can prove you can read, which probably means reading Latin, I suspect, at the time, that's how you prove you're a clergyman. Well, that then, for reasons I don't understand, apparently gets treated sufficiently loosely so that somebody you can't read, so that they normally test it by asking you to read a particular passage from the Bible, a particular verse of the Bible. So if you're worried about being tried, you memorize that passage. It got referred to as the neck verse because how you saved your neck. And then claim you can read by that. And presumably if the judge really wants to get you, he's going to ask you to read something else, but apparently it became quite common. So over time, they're weakening and weakening the criteria for what counts as a clergyman. But after the after Henry VIII abolishes Catholicism, in effect, in England and switches to Anglicanism, now the church doesn't really have courts that are doing most of those serious things. So I suppose the Anglican church must have had some church courts. But by the time you get to the 17th or 18th century, I think, the church courts are covering things like marriage law and I guess a few other things, but aren't really involved with in the sorts of things they've been involved in 500 or 600 years earlier. So at that point, you've created almost an accidental get-out-of-jail-free card. And then they start narrowing that down over time by doing things like at one point saying that even if you complete benefit of clergy, we can lock you up for a year before we let you out for that. And then at a different point saying benefit of clergy, you get transported, but it's for a shorter period. And increasingly shifting crimes out of clergy law. So that as that you get to the point where stealing 40 shillings or more counts as a non-clergical offense, where stealing from a house where there are people who might be put in fear by your stealing is a non-clergical offense, sheep stealing is a non-clergical offense. So it looks as, I mean, I don't really understand very well the dynamics of law in England in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, which are going to be the relevant periods. But it looks as though there's a whole lot of inertia in the system. And no one is in a position to sort of rewrite it de novo. I wonder if Cromwell tried. He would be the obvious person to have done it, but I just don't know. And thus you get, instead of saying, let's throw out this whole benefit of clergy, you say, let's narrow it more and more, and start saying it's not a complete get-out-of-jail card, it's sort of a partial get-out-of-jail card, and so forth.
So it's too hard for the court to just even justify it, to say this person just gets a,
very hard, yeah.
Mark on their thumb.
But that's what the rules say. Well, but of course, one thing that does mean is you can only do it once. So in that sense, I'm not sure if that was the function. That might be the reason for branding on the thumb. We can then check you. Again, it's not like they have good records. It's not like they can say, we can look up your social security number and see if you've completed benefit of clergy before you just look at your thumb and see if you've done it. So
there are two additional factors. One is the clergy of the Christian church didn't want to be in a position to execute anymore because they felt like it was fundamentally un-Christian. And the second argument is that that's where we later developed our concept of manslaughter as a secondary form of murder that was somewhat justifiable or at least not premeditated, and so therefore we were willing to ascribe it to a different level of punishment. Manslaughter deliberately actually is directly traced from the old I impugn to the clergy form, and then the church didn't execute you, but they would be in jail. But that's what we got. Because in the old days, murder was murder. It didn't matter what the circumstances were unless you were doing it under, king's orders.
But of course, in the old days, murder was a tort and not a crime. You're just one of these modernists who think that the Norman kings are old days. But in any case, that's my understanding of history, and you probably should go to somebody who really is an expert in early English legal history to get a better story. But that's what I could make out of it. Yeah.
I was wondering if you'd be willing to explain a little bit some of the comparisons you draw. So you're talking about the comparative cost or benefits of different punishments. Mm-hmm. And you say that a costly collected fine has
zero
an inefficiency
cost.
Of zero.
Right.
Because what one person loses, another gets.
Yes, right.
Then you say that prosecution is one.
Yes.
Because one person loses something, but no one gets it.
Right.
But the
imprisonment is higher than one.
Greater than one. But to me, that seems to depend on the assumption that losing one's liberty is about equal to losing one's life.
No. It does not depend on that in the least. The point is that I'm looking at the ratio of punishment cost to amount of punishment. And the reason I'm doing that is suppose we've got two punishments. one of which in some measure has a cost of $1,000 and one cost, sorry, has a effect on the criminal of $1,000, the cost of the criminal of $1,000 and one of $500. To get the same deterrent effect, you would have to impose the $500 one twice as often. Think about it as a probability punishment mix. Well, that would also double whatever the social cost was of it. So what I'm really saying is the ratio of net cost to cost to the criminal is the relevant measure of inefficiency, because if you're imagining substituting between different punishments, the higher the cost to the criminal, the less often you have to impose the punishment in order to get the same deterrent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but you seem to stop at the 0, 1, and greater than 1. You don't seem to measure it against the cost of the criminal to create that ratio.
I don't. It's a ratio. A ratio doesn't change if you change both top and bottom part.
Okay, then maybe I don't understand why
the... Imagine that any punishment we can think of as a certain number of dollars fine to the criminal. And that's going to be a little fuzzy when you think about things like execution, but you can sort of say how much do people value their life judging by what precautions they will take to avoid death and such. And we say, all right, here is a $10,000 punishment and here's a $5,000 punishment. And the $10,000 punishment has a net cost of $1,000. And the $500 punishment has a net cost of $900. Sorry, $5,000. I claim that the higher, the more severe punishment is more efficient, because you would only have to impose it half as often, and therefore the total social cost would be lower. Think of it in a model in which we're trying to deter crime by setting up a situation where if you commit a crime, you know there is, on average, a certain punishment or something. That's a probability times an amount of punishment.
Wouldn't it be not how many times you have to impose it, but rather what the ratio is?
What probability you have to impose it with. If I've got a choice between executing one person or imprisoning two people for the same crime, I'm saying I can either have the legal system say we'll catch one killer in six and execute him, or we'll try harder, we'll catch one in three but only lock them up for 10 years or something. Right? Imagine that kind of trade-off. And think about it as comparing different combinations of probability and punishment that have the same deterrent effect. So every time you lower the punishment, you have to raise the probability by a proportional amount in some sense. We can then say the dead weight cost, the net cost of deterring this crime is the cost for one punishment times the number of punishments. So therefore, if cost per amount of deterrence is lower for a particular punishment than for another one, then using that one will result in lower total ones, because we've got to try to produce the same amount of deterrence. That's the basic argument. And the puzzle is why we don't do it. That is the puzzle. The way I present this, I think, in Law's Order is I say, I've got this great scheme for improving our legal system. Suppose you've got some offense for which the current punishment is 10 years in jail. And at the moment, we're catching some percentage of the criminals and imposing that punishment. And suppose we could somehow find out by appropriate studies that a criminal was indifferent between 10 years in jail with certainty and one chance in six of being executed. Right. My improvement is very simple. After you convict somebody, roll a die. 1 to 5, you send them home. 6, you execute. And my claim is that that system will have exactly the same deterrent effect. Right? It has exactly the same total cost to criminals, distributed differently, and it saves us the cost of the jails. What's not to like about it? All right? And I've got more extreme versions, but it raises the puzzle of why we use inefficient punishments. The more extreme versions are the ones in which not only we execute you, we also forfeit your organs for transplant. Now we actually execution is becoming a more efficient crime than before, because we're getting something out of it. And the problem with it, it turns out after I think after I wrote, at least after I started writing the article, it turned out that a science fiction author had seen the hole in what's wrong with this approach. Larry Niven has a science fiction series which starts out with a bogus history of the near future in which it occurs to someone that if we're going to execute people anyway since there's a shortage of organs, we've got to forfeit their organs for transplant. And one country after another does this. How can you object? You were just wasting it before. But then the eventual result is, since there's still a shortage of organs, there's political pressure to have more and more crimes declared capital. And that's the problem. The problem is that, especially if you make punishment profitable, now whoever isn't being punished has an incentive to push for more punishment. Yeah.
I think I have three problems with this
model. Right.
The first, obviously, being that in all modern Westernized societies, this whole strange concept of due process definitely inserts inefficiencies. That's just something we've accepted.
How do you know it's inefficient? After all, we don't deter people if we punish the innocent.
What you're suggesting by rolling dice is obviously not going to pass due process.
Oh, that might be, but in terms of due process in our present system, the argument would be that it's a way of making it more likely that we get guilty people rather than innocent people.
What I'm saying is that it's clearly more costly to have criminal trials than it is to not have criminal trials. The big reason that we have in Western society is the ability for people to be assumed innocent instead of assumed guilty. The more efficient to be assumed guilty than innocent.
Wouldn't it be more efficient?
Sure.
Because we'd have seen the wrong people. We'd be imposing a cost and getting no deterrence out of it.
Yes, but you would have, your argument is that we would have a larger deterrent effect if you have a higher percentage of getting killed.
A higher percentage of guilty people getting killed. It does no good to randomly kill people.
Well, it'd be highly deterrent anyway.
No, it wouldn't be deterrent. If you say to people, we are going to pick, every time there's a murder, we'll pick one person at random and execute him. That does not deter murders.
Sure. But it would, well, I think that would, all deterrable murders then would be deterred.
No, they wouldn't. No murder would be deterred by that because the chance of getting executed isn't increased by committing a murder. It's increased by a tiny amount. You're one out of 300 million.
That model is too simplistic because it's normalizing all people. It's normalizing people from all socioeconomic backgrounds. It's normalizing.
How is it normalizing all people?
Well,
explain.
Your fine example, I think, is easier than the death example.
Right.
So if you're saying that if you charge a $10,000 fine for a particular offense or a $5,000 fine for a particular offense, depending on how much you enforce that, somebody like Warren Buffett is not as deterred as the guy who's begging on the side of the street.
If you go on my webpage, you will find an article entitled "Should the Rich Pay Higher Fines?" in which I run through the analysis in order to show why under some circumstances it's economically efficient for rich to pay higher fines and under some circumstances it isn't. Continue. This is not a new argument.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to make sure that it's said that deterrent effects vary not only over socioeconomic backgrounds, but also personality types. A sociopath will never be deterred based on potential punishment.
Why not? Sociopath is somebody who doesn't care about other people. He cares about himself.
Exactly.
So therefore, potential punishment will deter him if the result of the potential punishment is that he loses by committing the offense?
Only if his ultimate goal is self-preservation as opposed to just a egotistic...
Self-preservation is a very egotistic objective.
What I'm saying is that certain people, I mean, the brass tacks of it is that certain people do bad things just to do bad things. And those kinds of folks, Charles Manson would not be deterred by the fact that he's going to be in prison.
Don't know.
But
he may have thought he could get away with it, yeah.
What your model ostensibly does is it normalizes all walks of personality type as well. It assumes that everybody is inherently self-preserving. And I think that a bulk of psychological evidence from prison studies would show that those who are susceptible to repeat offense have a different personality type than those who do not. repeat offenders would be less likely to be deterred, obviously.
Could be.
Well, I mean, that's empirical evidence.
I don't know the evidence. All I'm saying.
What I'm saying is that I think that that's the problem with the deterrent model as just a proportion.
Let me for a moment. Well, you finish and then let me.
Those are my three issues.
Because
the basic.
Because for a moment, to begin with, what is there are a couple of ways in which this law and econ model of thinking about criminal law is approximating the world. More or less reliably. One of them is that we frequently write as if every criminal faced the same probability of being caught. And that, actually, I don't follow that model in the particular article we just read for today, but most of the time you do, because it makes it much simpler to sort of write your models that way. And a more realistic picture would say one of the reasons that he commits a crime and he doesn't is that he knows perfectly well he's a skilled criminal, and that therefore the expected punishment is low for him and high for him. So that's one thing which we usually, though not always, assume away, and you could try to include. A different issue is the question of the rational model of human behavior, because that's part of what you're questioning, I think. And it seems to me that the argument for the rational model is not that it's a perfect model of human behavior, but that it is the best model we have for the behavior of people in general. That is, I can say I know certain ways in which I'm irrational, and I therefore can avoid having a bowl full of potato chips next to me.
What I was saying was that the rational model of human behavior applies differently for dutiful citizens to criminals. I think that you would find a personality difference of repeat offenders with respect to rational behavior than you would from those who don't have parties.
Is offender defined as someone who breaks the law or as somebody who does something generally seen as morally objectionable?
Well, since we're talking a legal term, or someone who breaks the law.
Then I think you're wrong, because after all, presumably almost all American citizens are offenders.
Well, potentially. If you're talking about a specific offense, not just anyone who breaks the law, I spent coming to school here.
That's right. So you're an offender. So does that mean you have a different personality type?
This is exactly the kind of like broad stroke oversimplification that I have an issue with. Speeding does not show the same disdain for...
But that's why I wanted to distinguish between offender in the sense of somebody who breaks the law and offender in the sense of somebody who does things generally seen as morally objectionable.
And that's why we have differences between like administrative violations and felons.
But I'm suggesting that your personality argument is much more plausible for the latter case than for the former case.
But at any rate, it is plausible. And it's certainly more applicable for the more offensive, morally repugnant cases than it is just administrative misdemeanor.
Right.
But regardless, the proportionality argument, as I have heard it presented, you're applying through all those offenses.
Don't you think that all of those people are more deterred by a more severe punishment and more deterred by a more certain punishment?
I think that the deterrence is not applicable broadly to all people for all types of offenses. I think I don't need a deterrence not to murder people except for my own moral guidelines.
It might depend how strong the temptation was.
Yeah, sure. But there are people out there who might be deterred by the threat of the death penalty. There are people who might be deterred by one day of jail.
Yeah.
And to say that the deterrent effects could be average over all of society in an efficient way, I have problems.
Well, wait a minute. First, I don't see how what the analysis I was giving him depends on that. It only depends on the idea that to get the same amount of deterrence with a smaller punishment requires a higher probability.
Right.
So that doesn't depend on whether the effect is identical for everybody, but only that relation is holds for everybody.
But when we say deterrence, we're talking about social deterrence, not an individual's deterrence.
Huh? I don't know what you mean.
We're talking about deterring crime in general, not for a particular.
You do it by deterring it for particular offenders.
Right.
I mean, that's,
I'm saying that deterrence, that what deters me is different than deters you.
Sure, but that's not inconsistent anything that I said.
What it does, though, is it averages my deterrence and your deterrence and his deterrence and everybody else's deterrence to say that this is the acceptable model of general social deterrent effect.
Maybe I'm dismissing what it is you're objecting to, because the question that I was that we were discussing was why, in measuring the efficiency of a punishment, I want to take it as a ratio of net cost to cost to the person who's punished. And I don't see how anything that you're saying undercuts that, because that simply depends on the idea that to get the same effect, whether for everybody or for a single person, I don't think it matters to the argument, from a weaker punishment, you would have to apply it with a higher probability.
Because my ratio might be different than your ratio.
Your ratio of what?
Of deterrence to cost to society.
Yeah, sure, it might be.
The cost to society can deter me from doing things.
Might be. Might very well be. What does that have to do with what we were discussing?
What you said is that doubling the deterrence will half the amount of
crime. I did not say that. I certainly did not say that. That's utter nonsense.
Then perhaps the reverse.
What I said was that doubling the probability and halving the punishment would result in the same level of deterrence as before.
Then I think that applies differently to different people.
It might well. It might, what that level of deterrence is would be different for different people. Witness the fact that at a given level, not everybody is deterred. The idea that the amount of deterrence is proportional to the punishment is just, there's no reason to believe that. That's a particular assumption about the supply curve for offenses, which is just as arbitrary as any other such assumption.
If my speeding tickets get doubled,
yes.
You were saying that
if the amount of,
then I have. That we would expect I would speed half them.
I said nothing of the sort.
Then the ratio of deterrence to the amount of crime you're saying is
that is nothing that I'm saying. I'm sorry, you completely misunderstood what I said. What I said was that if your speeding ticket was doubled and the probability of your being caught when you sped was cut in half, you would do the same amount of speeding. It's the probability not of your committing the crime, but if somebody who commits the crime being caught, that's the probability that I'm talking about. What I'm saying is that the appropriate estimate of the effective deterrence is that it would depend on the product of probability of, if you commit the offense, of being convicted and punished times the amount of the punishment. Now, that's not a perfect statement because you might not be risk neutral, but I think it's a pretty good approximation for most people. But that has nothing to do with claiming that the amount of crime will be proportional to that. That's just a misunderstanding of what I was saying.
I understand the distinction, but the ultimate goal is to provide an economically efficient deterrent effect to a particular group. That's the ultimate goal
of if you're doing a fully sort of economically optimal criminal punishment system. The goal is to have that combination of probability and punishment such that the net cost of crime plus the net cost of preventing crime is minimized.
That's the objective. That's what I understand you're saying, but I think my original point is still unsatisfied with that.
Which is that different people are different. That we agree to.
Yes, and I'm not sure that it's simple enough to say that we have reached an economic minimum or an economic maximum by just doing a simple ratio.
A simple ratio of what?
Of changing the probability of detection and the cost.
I didn't say that gave you an optimum. I said that left the amount of crime unchanged. The optimum, you have to figure out what the probability and punishment you wanted were. But that's not what you're saying. The claim is that in comparing the effect of amount of punishment and probability, that it makes sense to think of the expected cost to the offender of committing the offense as the product of probability times punishment. And that consequently you would think that to have the same amount of deterrence as you raise the punishment, you could lower the probability or vice versa. That doesn't say what the optimum is.
I understand that. That's a utility to approach the optimum.
It's not a utility to approach a problem. It's a description of the production function for deterrence.
Right.
Describing the production function for a service does not tell you where the optimum is.
Unless you know what inputs and outputs you can give. Something that you would use if society says we have this much to spend on deterrence, then
but society doesn't have this much to spend on deterrence.
That's beyond the point that I was trying to make. The point that I'm trying to make with respect respect to the analysis of equivalent deterrent effects.
Yes, that's
based
the question.
On probability of being caught multiplied by the ultimate the punishment.
By the cost of the punishment to the person who is punished as he evaluates it, yes.
I think the model is too simplistic because of both sides of that ratio, every single person will do.
That fact may be true and is no reason to imply the model is too simplistic. The model might be too simplistic for some reason, but the fact that the fact that the values are different for different people doesn't mean that it isn't still the case that for each of those people, as you increase the punishment and lower the probability, the deterrence will stay the same. It'll stay the same at a different level for different people because people are different.
Sure, but we can't build a system that deters individuals differently.
Of course we can. We know that we have all such systems because some people commit crimes and some don't.
That's right, and we don't.
So therefore, all systems deter different people differently.
That's exactly my point. But if we are trying to come up with an economically efficient system for deterrence,
yes,
you're going to have to accept that certain people will not be deterred.
Of course. Of course you do.
And I think that the model that you're suggesting to value approach the maximum economic efficiency.
I have not, in what I was saying to him, I was not discussing the question of what the maximum economically efficient level of punishment was. I was discussing the question of the trade-offs between probability and amount of punishment. And it might be the case that worked differently for different people, but nothing you say implies it, because the mere fact that the same probability punishment combination will deter some people and other people, which is obviously true, and goes into every model that discusses these things. Otherwise, you would always have either everybody or zero people committing crimes, which is not what we observe. That is not affected by does not prevent the point about probability punishment trade-offs. You know, if you're sufficiently interested, I can point you at the chapter of my Law and Econ book, in which I do indeed derive within my model what the optimal probability punishment combination is. And it certainly does not assume that everybody is equally deterred. On the contrary, it assumes that different people will be deterred by different levels of punishment, and you therefore have an elasticity of supply for offenses, and the elasticity of supply for offenses is one of the things that goes into figuring out the optimal punishment.
I think what that
you really can't critique theories without understanding them. I'm sorry.
I do understand your theory.
And then why did you, if you understand it, why did you think that I was saying that the amount of number of offenses decreased proportionally to the...
That's not what I said. What I'm saying is that I think for a society to function, my metric would be no crime.
That's not an option.
I think that is an option. There is. I think that would be the most. That would be the most pleasant society to live in, I suppose.
Depends on what. On the contrary, I can tell you how to get no crime. It's very easy. Kill everybody. That's not the most pleasant. That's not the most pleasant society to live in.
That ends justifying me. I'm not sure that that's.
But when you say that the ideal is no crime, you have to ask what is the cost of achieving that ideal, and if the cost of achieving the ideal is high enough, for example, killing everybody, then it's not the ideal.
Well, that's not the only way to reach a society of no crime.
But
what I'm saying is that your model necessarily puts a certain amount of crime will happen, and that the optimum, however it's approached or calculated, assumes a cost of crime. I think that the criminal and civil justice systems of all of the societies we've studied, the ultimate goal is to stop people from doing things that society has determined are harmful.
Whatever the cost?
Not whatever the cost.
Therefore, it's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is some balance between the desirability of reducing crime and the cost of reducing crime.
Yes, I understand.
What?
But that assumes that we have people who will always, who no matter what, how well they're educated, no matter how much they follow the tenets of society, will always commit wrongs. That's the assumption. That
I'm sorry. Making. Not however much they follow the tenets of society. The ones who are committing the wrongs are obviously violating a tenet of the society.
I'm saying that, like, if we increase, I believe that I'm being misunderstood.
That's possible. But given that you, I think, explicitly misunderstood me at the beginning, it's not clear to me that you've got a critique, because it isn't yet clear to me that you understand the ideas you're critiquing. You're welcome to come by my office if you want to sort of can use the greater length. But I have no objection to critiques. They make it much more interesting. But they do require that you follow what you're critiquing. Yep.
So you argue that it's easy to see how the English system is come up with you can say it's easy to see what the weaknesses are in the private prosecution
yes.
system. Can you clarify what's obvious, what the obvious weaknesses are?
The obvious weakness in that private prosecution system is that on the face of it, there isn't a reward for prosecuting. And that therefore, the incentive to prosecute either depends on being in a situation where you can make deterrence into a private good, or depends on being able to bargain with the criminal to get him to pay you off for dropping charges.
That's exactly what you say happens.
That is what happens, but there's no reason to assume it happens at the optimal level. That is to say, take the simple case. Suppose we have got a victim who correctly believes that he has only a very low probability of being a victim in the future. Therefore, the value of the reputation for prosecuting people isn't very high to him. A criminal who can only pay a trivial amount in order to pay to bribe the guy to drop the charges. And the cost of bringing the witnesses and arraigning everything is sizably higher than that trivial amount. That crime doesn't get prosecuted unless the guy is sufficiently vengeful or something, but in the simple version. In a perfectly run system of government prosecution, the government would hire police, they would tell the police, this crime is worth getting prosecuted, we have a public prosecutor, and so forth. So the weakness of the system, it seems to me, this version of private enforcement, is that it doesn't have a sort of a built-in incentive to make sure that offenses are worth getting prosecuted, get prosecuted. But it does have several potential sort of cures for this, that in general sort of what's referred to as market failure in the economic literature doesn't really mean things don't get produced. It just means you don't have a good reason to expect the optimum, to be confident that things that are worth producing get produced, if that makes sense. All right. The other?
Actually, yep. I was wondering, because you talked very lightly about how they had imprisonment before this system and how it eventually evolved into
afterwards. That is, as far as I can tell, at least during this period, they had imprisonment only for minor offenses, for
right.
things like vagrancy. They locked people up prior to trial for serious offenses, but that theoretically wasn't the punishment. That was just holding them until the court met, basically. Though, in fact, of course, it would have been a punishment from their standpoint.
And then I wasn't really sure. You kind of inferred that they decided that because they were locking them up for a while before the trial, and then they were essentially parting them, saying something like time served is...
In the 18th century, for serious crimes, there isn't a sentence of imprisonment.
Right.
It's not one of the options. And about the end of the 18th and early 19th century, that starts changing. And I'm not sure of the reasons that part of what's going on is an ideological shift toward... There's been this sort of back and forth forever, as far as I can tell, between the idea of deterrence and the idea of reform. That one theory is you punish people so it's not worth their while to commit crimes. And one thing is you aren't really punishing them at all, you're re-educating them. You're locking them up while you make them into better people. And early 19th century, you're getting, I think, a shift towards the latter view. So that the term penitentiary means a place where you learn to repent of your offenses. The term reform school is a place where you are reformed. And what's actually happening in the early 19th century is you're not just locking people up, you're preaching at them, you're maybe trying to teach them a trade, you're doing various things which you at least believe are going to make them the kind of personality type who won't commit a crime rather than the type who did. And that is in that sense, the 18th century English looked to me much more like law and econ types than the 19th century English, if that makes sense, because the 18th century English, as far as I can tell, their attitude was the reason he's a criminal is it pays better than his other alternatives. even if they don't put it in that fashion, which would be the sort of the economist's first estimate, whereas the 19th century view tends to be much more is the reason he's a criminal is ignorant of the fact that he shouldn't be a criminal. So that's one of the incentives for imprisonment. What the others were, I don't know. The fact that the only place that you can transport people to is much farther away and more expensive might have affected it. The fact that the society is getting richer might have affected it, and so forth.
Yeah, I was actually also wondering about its relationship with transportation, and more about how they went from a system that had imprisonment to a system that didn't. I was wondering if the ability to use transportation to the New World.
I don't think that's a fair analysis. England never had a system where imprisonment was a common punishment.
For serious crimes, at least.
It only moved into as essentially there was this growing tendency to send people away, and coupled with that was a gradual increase in using the imprisonment as a punishment until suddenly transportation drops off the cliff when Australia ceases to become a place where you can transport people, and now imprisonment is the only way to go for England, imprisonment or execution.
Well, they could have had a space program.
Those two things are roughly in parallel in the early 1800s until transportation really drops off the cliff and ceases to become viable. But earlier on in England's history, there was never imprisonment.
Okay, I was.
I have another question.
Yes.
You say that prosecution associations are not likely insurance, but actually demonstrations of commitment.
Yes.
Why do you make that argument?
My argument is that the prosecution association is a way of solving the problem that after the fact it's your interest not to prosecute. That's at least my interpretation of what's going on.
Say that again.
That they're a way of solving the problem that after the crime has occurred, it's not in your interest to prosecute, but before the crime occurs, it is in your interest to be going to prosecute. This is the standard commitment problem, the situation where it is in my interest that at some future time I do something. But if that future time occurs, it's not in my interest, because the reason it's my interest is that you're knowing that I would do that changes what you do in such a way that the event doesn't occur. Right? And you can think of all sorts of contexts where that kind of situation exists.
And this is based on the fundamental principle that during this time period, there really was no benefit to the people bringing the prosecution. It was essentially a cost for them.
There could be. I have two different explanations. So there's the possibility that sometimes there's the benefit of the out-of-court implicit settlement. But aside from that, for most people, there was a negligible benefit. That the exception would be the person who was really a likely repeat victim where he can establish a relationship.
So
that's the argument.
So that's the explanation for why the association served as a signaling mechanism, saying we're really serious about prosecuting the time against us.
And not just saying it, making it true. You know, the sort of the classic commitment strategy is Odysseus tying himself to the mast so he can listen to the sirens without plunging into the ocean and drowning. And you can think of all of these things as versions of that. That if you could imagine it in a different world, that I say, all right, I'm going to give $1,000 to you, and your instructions are, if somebody commits a crime against me this year and I don't prosecute, give the $1,000 to charity. That would be a different way of achieving the same thing, but this was just the mechanism they found for getting that. It's a way of tying your hands. Yes?
After reading through the article and like getting a whole sense of the whole system and how it operates, would you say it's fair to describe the system as one, and coupling that with the fact that it seems like our current system is one with a greater variety of options,
absolutely.
Of punishment options?
Yes.
The punishment options are more complex. Would you say that it's fair to describe the 18th century English law as a system in which right or precise answers are less important than fast or...
Might be. That is one interpretation, at least, is that one virtue of imprisonment is you can graduate it, and that's at least harder to do. In principle, they could have had transportation for different lengths of time, but there's enough of a fixed cost. For one thing, I don't go into it in there, but I think that in the 18th century, going to the New World was quite likely to kill you. Due to different environment diseases and so forth. That might not be as 10%, 15%. But my impression is that I'm pretty sure it's true in the 17th, I think it's so true in the 18th century, that there's quite a sizable mortality rate for immigrants. So in that sense, it's sort of a fixed punishment. Now, as you put it greater than some, and maybe they should have, but yes, it looks like a system where, for whatever reason, they're working with a very small palette of options. And it's not, you know, I have to know more than I do about how those people thought to be able to tell you why, whether they thought that justice just wasn't an issue. Because one of the impressions you get in some of the stuff is that the 18th century is also a lot less moralistic than the 19th century. That there's sort of a sense of, well, if I were in this situation, I would have done it too. So the problem is not giving people what they deserve, it's keeping stuff from being stolen. But I'm not sure if that's right. That's
sure. I'm looking at our system and it seems more finely tuned.
Yes.
But the cost of reaching more precise answers, or specifically, more precise deterrence, is itself inefficient.
But the other problem is, if you assume that they're both being run by sort of philosopher kings, then our system has an obvious advantage. But I don't really know whether our gradations are being used sensibly. Right? It's not like we've got a good theoretical reason to think that the mechanism that sets punishments for crimes actually does it right. We don't have a very good theory of how governments work.
Okay. Sure.
So in that, So in that, but certainly having a more flexible palette in principle ought to be an advantage, unless it were the case that there was one. You could say, I mean, alternative argument, suppose that executing people is really the most efficient punishment that your society has available. Well, then just execute everybody with different probabilities. That's sort of a version of my rolling dice model.
Right, and that's basically what I'm trying to get at.
And that would grade deterrence. It would just grade it by probability rather than punishment.
I suppose I was trying to point out a deficiency in our system,
yep.
Namely that while one advantage is that we have more precise punishments,
yep.
It's very costly to get to those punishments.
Yeah, well, certainly our trial procedure is much more expensive than theirs as far as we can tell. They pretty much aren't using lawyers for trials. I think it's probably the end of the 18th century before it's common to have either side represented by a lawyer, unless, I suppose, if you had a prosecution association, maybe the agent might be a lawyer. I don't know the person who's doing it for you. So in that end, I think trials were fairly fast by our standards. So in that sense, you have a more expensive system. And we hope that the usual argument for that is they want to do a better job of separating out guilty from innocent. And as far as I can tell, we really have very bad data on that. I had a project I tried to get people interested in 15 or 20 years ago to use the